Hello, and welcome back for another edition of Noir on the Radio. I'm Greg Barth, and joining me this time is Sam Weeb. Sam Weeb's novel, Last of the Independents, won the Kobo Emerging Writer Prize and an Arthur Ellis Award, and was nominated for a Seamus Award. His second novel, Invisible Dead, was published by Random House Canada and Quercus USA. His short stories have appeared in Thug Lit, Spine Tinkler, and Subterrane. And he was the 2016 Vancouver Public Library Writer in Residence. That latest release, Invisible Dead, just came out about 3 weeks ago, and he's here this evening to talk to us about it. Sam Weeb, welcome to Noir on the Radio. Thanks for spending some time with us this evening.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
All right. So, Sam, if you would, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, experience, the things that make you the writer that you are today.
Well, I started writing seriously about 6 years ago. I was just finishing up grad school and, I'd incurred a bunch of student debt, and I sort of realized that it was make or break time, right? If it wasn't going to happen then it wasn't going to happen at all. So I spent most of my last year of grad school, when I should have been writing my honors paper, working on the book that became Last of the Independents. That novel I submitted to the manuscript competition that the Crime Writers of Canada runs, which is the Arthur Ellis Awards, and it was shortlisted and then won that award, and Dundurn Press sponsored the competition and decided to publish it. While all that was going on, I was trying to get an agent and finally succeeded in doing that, and then sold this newest book, Invisible Dead, which just came out a couple weeks ago in the States.
Well, great. Yeah, it's amazing how debt can be a motivator. Those student loans are pesky and lingering, it seems. Your latest Invisible Dead, just out from Hachette earlier this month, it's kind of a missing person PI novel featuring Dave Wakeland as the protagonist. How would you describe this novel for our listeners who may not be familiar with it yet?
Well, it's, I come from the background of, someone who grew up reading all the great classic detective novels, right? All the Chandlers and Ross MacDonalds. And I really wanted to find a way to update that, to use the stuff that I like from those novels to write about, present-day Vancouver. I really didn't want to have, a PI in a trench coat calling women dames in 2017 Vancouver. That just seemed silly. But the thing about those old novels that I loved is that they're all about small business people, right? People who have to constantly make ethical decisions and balance that against making a living. So the book, it follows a 29-year-old detective named David Wakeland, who's hired to find a missing sex trade worker who disappeared a decade ago. And, her mother at the time didn't have the money to pursue this case, but now she does and wants to find out what happened to her daughter. And the book sort of takes him throughout the different classes and social groups of Vancouver and, hopefully just shows a little bit about how the sex trade, works on all those levels, like the effect of all that. So that's what I was hoping for.
Wow, that's a great setup. One of the cool things about this character, Dave Wakeland, he's a PI, but he works with an agency as a corporate partner, Jeff Chin, and he doesn't necessarily call his own shots, it seems, or at least not without creating tension within his partnership. It's a business, I guess, and I think that gives it a certain sense of realism. It feels like a unique setup. I mean, I know there was Spade and Archer, back in the day. But, having this setup, I think, takes away a bit of the cliche around the lone PI. What were you going for in setting it up this way?
Well, when I wrote Last Day Independence, I did do the lone PI thing. And, you know, I had a guy in, like, a ramshackle office in the rougher part of Vancouver, you know, solving cases out of that. In the last couple of years, Vancouver has gentrified to the point that those areas are now, you know, million-dollar homes. Not even homes, like condos. So there's really no way that, you know, like a small PI firm could be viable in that. So I wanted to go the opposite way and actually make someone who's had some success in that business. You know, he's partnered up with someone who's really business savvy and has, you know, a strong sense of ethics. And, you know, the tension between them is sort of, you know, crucial to the story. You know, Dave is kind of the obsessive personality type, but he's always being roped back in by his partner who's saying, no, like, we have to pay bills, we have to make money, we have clients that are actually paying us. And, you know, there's a part of the story where he's sort of yanked away from his case in order to do something that at the time seems totally unrelated and totally a waste of time, and just to appease that corporate side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really cool setup. And I've also seen that you intend to make Dave Wakelin a series character. What kinds of things do writers have to take into consideration when coming up with a character that they and their readers are going to be spending a lot of time with over the years?
You know, I mean, I wish I knew. At the time, I was just sort of working to the book. But, yeah, the second book should be out in February of 2018. I think it really comes down to tone, right? Like, what sets apart the great detective novels, whether it's Chandler or, you know, James Crumley or, you know, up to Sue Grafton and later writers, is that they have a tone and there's a personality that you want to spend time with. So the cases are really important. The mystery is important. The story is important. But it's also someone where, you know, you'd want to hang out with Kinsey Millhone, or you'd want to hang out with, you know, Lou Archer. I mean, it's really built around that, you know, that character and that tone.
Yeah, that's cool. I think, and I can sympathize on the, at the beginning when you said you wish you knew, I kind of found myself writing a series by accident about a character, and man, there would have been 100 things I would have changed in that first book if I knew I was going to keep writing about that character. It's funny. So this novel takes place in Vancouver, BC. How important is setting to your stories, and why this city?
Well, essentially, and you know, as you're saying, like, things that you wish you'd know. You know, when I started writing, I didn't know about any of the publishing markets, and I didn't realize that, you know, books set in Canada are sort of, you know, it's not really a popular setting unless you're Louise Penny or, you know, someone like that. But, you know, Vancouver's the only city I really know really well, and I think it's also, it's a city with a real beautiful tourist face and then a really ugly, you know, underside. And hopefully what I can do in the book is just show how those sides are connected. So the setting is really everything. It's the one thing that I couldn't change, you know, about the book. You know, it really is about Vancouver.
Nice. And there seems to be an underlying message in this book, I would say, about, you know, the women on the fringe of society, low value people, if you will, sex workers, how they're looked upon, treated. Are you hoping the reader will come away from this book with something to think about on that subject?
Yeah. You know, I really hate the use of female characters as a way to create a convenient corpse, or, you know, to create some sort of change in the main character. You know, if Wakelin has a change in this story, it's really just him realizing how complicit and how involved, you know, everyone who lives in the city is in what happens to them. You know, Vancouver has, you know, a large population of at-risk people, you know, a lot of whom are addicts and sex trade workers, and a large proportion of them are people of color. And it was really important to me to, you know, I can't tell that story of all those missing people myself, because I'm a 30-year-old white guy, but I felt if I could just focus on one missing person and sort of use that to show what goes on and what happens, you know, I thought there would be some value in that beyond just telling a good story.
And was that the kind of thing, Sam, that took a lot of research? Did you have to put in a lot of time and effort to really understand that type of person, what their lives were like? How do you go about that?
I'm lucky in that I know a couple of people who are in that line of work, and you know, I could talk to them about what they went through. But also, you know, when I started writing this, it was during the there was a commission, a judicial hearing into the murdered missing women in British Columbia. I don't know how familiar your readers are about this, but there's several serial killers actively targeting at-risk women over the last 30 years. And so, you know, when I would talk to people who were either journalists or, you know, in law enforcement or who had some role in the sex trade or any of those sort of you know, involved lifestyles, I'd always hear what the commission was missing, right? What they weren't focusing on, how they'd sort of silence, you know, like the voices of some of the families who didn't get to speak at this hearing. And that was sort of the jumping off point for the research that I did.
Wow, yeah, that's pretty heavy. on maybe a lighter note, I like the music references in the book. How important is music to you? Is it an inspiration for your writing? And can you maybe comment a little on Dave's taste in music and what it tells us about him?
Yeah, well, I mean, I started out as a musician, a drummer. I don't know if you count that as a musician, but you know, I always thought that was an important part of the Rebus series by Ian Rankin, which I love. And, you know, you know so much about his character from the music that he chooses. In Wakelin's case, you know, he's a big fan of, you know, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and that sort of kind of darker, rockier, heavier sound. And, you know, I didn't want to make him sort of an obsessive, you know, music hound and throw in references just for the sake of throwing them in, but I thought that they did sort of add something to the book. And, you know, there are some great local artists that I wanted to spotlight and sort of mention. And, you know, it's interesting. The editor for the book, he was the first person to say, oh, I've never heard someone reference the Hanson Brothers, which is this, you know, punk band from Victoria. And, you know, that just that kind of stuff that sort of gives it a little bit of local flavor and a little bit of, you know, its own feeling. And also, you know, most detectives are so much older and they're just sort of jazz fans or you know, classic rock fans that, you know, having someone talk about, well, Soundgarden, for instance, you know, I thought it just made it a little bit different, a little bit younger, skewing. Hopefully.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. I know I become introduced to a lot of music I would have never heard before through books like this. I think of Ken Bruin does that a lot, and he'll mention, you know, the authors that his characters are reading and that type of thing. And, you know, it just kind of opens up a new world, even to the reader. You know, you can you can listen to some of the same music that the characters are listening to, and it's just another connection sometimes. It's pretty cool. If Invisible Dead was option for a movie and was produced and put out there, who would be your pick, your dream pick to cast as Wakelin?
Oh man, if I could get if I could go back like 30 years or 40 years and get like the Ray Winston from have you ever seen the movie Scum? Like his early film.
I haven't.
It's actually a Borstal movie. It's not even a prison movie. It's set in like a juvenile hall, but Ray Winston has sort of become this great hulking brute of a guy, but back in the earlier days he had like a really expressive face, a really canny kind of face, and that would be great. But as far as like contemporary actors, again, like I just like Tom Hardy, so I don't even know if he'd be right for the movie, but he's awesome.
Yeah, I see that. I just made a note to check out Scum, the movie. But yeah, I think Tom Hardy would be great too. So the title, Invisible Dead, it seems significant and something a lot of thought was put into. How did you come up with that title, and what are you trying to evoke in the reader's mind with that?
The original title of the book was Chelsea Loam, which is the missing person's name. And unfortunately, as much as I like the way that sounded, it wasn't. It didn't sound like a crime novel. So I spent a lot of time trying to think of a replacement. And I think what I liked about Invisible Dead was it gave the sense that there was more going on than just what was in the book, and that there's stuff that that we miss or that we take for granted, as we're walking around. Today I'm in Seattle and it's a beautiful day and I'm here with my girlfriend and it's amazing, but there's also, there's other stuff going on that I'm oblivious to. And if you, go down the wrong alley or you look under a bridge, you're going to see an entirely different world. So, there's a line in the book that someone becomes like the most visible dead person in the city, but, there's a lot of people that go unseen.
Nice. We just had a caller that tried to come through, and it looks like they disconnected. It looked like it was a 506 area code. If that caller would like to try again, we'll be glad to take your call live on the air for the next few minutes while we're on. Sam, you've written at least one other PI novel, and I'm thinking about Last of the Independents. What would you like our listeners to know about that one?
It's good. I think that's about it.
there you go.
I really enjoyed writing that book, and I think in a way it was a real discovery process for me. I didn't really go to like creative writing school. I don't have an MFA or anything like that. So, the way I learned was just by doing it. And I think the book is really energetic and it's very youthful. And I do take a lot of pride in it. And, it sort of set the stage for Invisible Dead. So I look at it as like a really good demo album, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I like that. What do you think draws you, me, the readers, my audience, for that matter, to this kind of dark fiction?
I think it's I like to think of it as realistic fiction. I think it looks at society realistically. I don't try to throw in a lot of violence just for the sake of violence, but I do try to write about violence in a way that's reflective of the impact it has. And the great thing about crime fiction is that you get it both ways. You get the vicarious enjoyment, but you can also get, sort of a deeper look at how violence affects people, right? In the case of a missing person, what happens when someone doesn't show up? And then, years pass. Like, what happens to a family that goes through that? That's really interesting stuff to me. And, I think that people are drawn to you know, not only the enjoyment of like a mystery story, but also, you know, someone writing about a real place and then maybe trying to say something about that. You know, that's what draws me to, you know, Ian Rankin or Sue Grafton or Tana French or, you know, any of the other billion amazing writers like Walter Mosley. You know, they have something to say about the world that their character lives in and that we live in.
Yeah, you get to know a lot of places through this this type of fiction, because it seems like the setting is, well, I think Reed Farrell Coleman said last week that the setting is the soil out of which the story grows, and you get a feel for these cities or, you know, these rural places in fiction like this. It's kind of cool. Let's talk a little bit about writing itself. What does writing look like for you? Do you write every day? Do you outline your plots? Do you just kind of jump in and start typing away? How does that work for you?
I usually have the bare bones of the story when I start. And, you know, often I don't have a full outline, but I'll have, you know, the 10 major beats or, you know, a vague idea of where I'm going. And I'll just sit down and write by hand, you know, usually in like a Cambridge notepad. And, you know, the book literally looks like 11 notepads in my terrible writing. Then I type it up, and editing takes, you know, at least the same amount of time as writing the first draft. I go back through every chapter and often rewrite it entirely or, you know, fix plot holes or things like that. So, you know, it takes about a year to come up with something that I'm happy showing to other human beings. And, you know, the great thing about Invisible Dead is just the publishing process and the editing was so great. You know, getting the feedback from someone who's edited other books that you really like and, you know, someone that you respect and who gets the story is really helpful. I find that about my agent, too. Like, when he suggests something, sometimes I'll bridle and be like, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, or you just want this to be more commercial. And then I'll walk away, and the next week I'll go, oh, crap, you're right. You know, that idea I had was stupid, and this is better. So it's, you know, it's a long process, but, you know, hopefully it just preserves the same original, you know, idea that I started with.
Yeah, that process kind of begs the question, just curious, why write by hand, you know, pen and notebook?
Well, there's two reasons. One, I'm a terrible typist. But also, you know, when I was in college, I realized that, you know, you have so much going on, and you're taking so many courses, and there's so much other stuff you're doing that it's very easy to get distracted. So just going down to the bare bones and sitting on your couch and putting on some music or you know, even just, you know, silence, it really allows you to just focus on the story and nothing else. And, you know, for me, that's the most the truest way to get the story out. You know, I write and I don't do a whole lot of you know, editing as I'm working on that first draft, so, you know, sometimes there are things that I have to fix, but, you know, the story comes out I think just the best that way.
Interesting. Yeah. Which authors would you say have had the most influence on you as a writer?
Oh, man. You know, when I was a kid, you know, my dad's favorite writer is John D. MacDonald, the author of the Travis McGee series and Cape Fear and all
yeah.
sorts of great things. And he had all those books. And I read through all of those when I was, you know, in my teens. And my mom was actually a Dashiell Hammett fan. I remember her having like paperback copies of Red Harvest. So, you know, that's really where I started. You know, as far as like contemporary writers, you know, Tana French, like reading that first Dublin Murder Squad book, it's just sort of like, oh, this is what I aspire to. And there's an Australian writer named Peter Temple who writes a series about a detective named Jack Irish. And again, like, I read those and I just go, wow, this is light years beyond me, but it's what I want to get to.
Good stuff. let's say we, excuse me, my allergies are destroying my voice today, it seems. Let's say there's someone out there listening who has written a bit, you know, maybe some short stories, and they're now sitting down to write their first novel. What advice would you give to that person?
Well, you know, the great thing about having written a few short stories is that you're going through the same process in miniature, right? You're learning how to draft and how to revise and then how to submit it and how to take rejection. So when you write a novel, you're going to go through all of those things on a much grander scale. And it's going to be more fun and it's going to be more painful, but it's the same basic thing. You know, just when you're starting out, don't show it to anyone and don't worry too much about it. You know, like, when I started out, my goal was to write a book. And then I wrote one, and it wasn't that good. So the next year, my goal was write a good book. And that's what became Last of the Independents, something where I was, you know, proud of it. But that learning process involved writing that first shitty novel. And that's okay. But I think you have to start from that point of, you know, I'm going to do this no matter what, and I'm going to have to, you know, you just, it really comes down to faith, as weird as it is to say. Like, you have to just keep going until you finish and not worry too much about what could happen to it, you know. And then ultimately you just train yourself to know when you're happy with it, and that's what it's all about, I think.
I like that. I think that's sound advice. I think it's, you know, it's much like any other art or craft out there. No painter sat down and painted a masterpiece the first time out. Nobody's first poem was a knockout, and, you know, nobody's sitting down to sew up an outfit or something like that by hand. You know, the first time out is always not the best, but you have to learn the skills and gain familiarity with the process, and you get there. Good advice. You know, I think of writers as entertainers, Sam, and I'm always curious, you know, what entertains the entertainers out there. So, you know, what are you reading these days, listening to, watching for entertainment currently?
Well, my girlfriend and I are rewatching The Sopranos right now. We just sort of finished season two, and you know, I think that golden age of HBO shows like The Sopranos and Deadwood and The Wire, I think that's going to be pretty hard to top. I mean, there's great TV out there, you know, right now. I'm really enjoying Bosch. I love the way that they sort of took the Michael Connelly novels and, you know, built up some of the secondary characters to make them more, you know, more a part of the story. So I really like that show. As far as reading, you know, again, like, there's so much great stuff in the past. I've been on a Stephen King kick, and, you know, I'd never read The Shining, and I'd never read Salem's Lot, so I read both of those, and just incredible. You know, the way he describes, like, working-class life, just even just putting the you know, the supernatural stuff aside is brilliant. There's just a lot of great writers out there, and, you know, the problem is you start naming them and then you leave people out. Like, Megan Abbott's last book was really great, and David Swinson, who's written three books now, I mean, he's incredible. There's just too much to there's too much to name.
I agree with you on those HBO shows. That was kind of like a golden age, and there's you know, it seems to be kind of a resurgence and kind of golden age of the noir genre these days too in fiction. So it's an exciting time. What are the new and exciting projects that you're working on these days that we can look forward to in the days to come?
Well, I'm currently waiting for my editor to give me my last notes on the sequel to Invisible Dead, which is going to be called Cut You Down, and that'll be the second Wakeland novel, and that comes out February 2018. I'm also working on revising book three, so that's taken up a lot of time. I'm editing an anthology, and I'm doing a little bit of like TV and film work that I'm hoping will pay off, but I'm not, you know, I'm putting, I'm not, I'm holding my breath on that. But yeah, it's there's a lot of stuff in the works. I'm really excited for the next book to come out.
Very nice. Yeah, can't wait to see that. So where's the best place out there on the web for, you know, folks to find out about what's going on and keep up with what you're doing?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Sam_Wiebe, W-I-E-B-E, and I'm on Facebook at WiebeSam, W-I-E-B-E-S-A-M, and I have a website, which is just my name, samwiebe.com. Feel free to drop me a line and, you know, tweet if you like, and feel free not to do that. I'm totally happy if people just want to, you know, read the books and not do that too. Oh,
wow.
I hope that didn't
yeah.
sound
well,
too negative. I just mean, like, you know, it's always nice to meet people in person.
Yeah, no, not at all. I think it comes across as intended. Good stuff, Sam. You know, thanks so much for coming on the show and talking to us about your work. It really has been a blast having you on. And you know, let's keep in touch. And when Cut You Down comes out in February, let's talk about that one if you'd like.
That sounds great, Greg. My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you're welcome. And for the listeners, man, I encourage you to check out Sam Wiebe's latest, Invisible Dead. It's fantastic. It's everything that this show is dedicated to, and then some. It's perfect for this audience. And keep a watch out for Cut You Down in February 2018. And while you're at it, keep an eye out for my upcoming release, Everglade, which is the fifth and last volume in the Selena series. It's going to be out on July 1st from All Due Respect Books. So until next time, this is Greg Barth with Noir on the Radio. And Noir on the Radio is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC.